They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. Got a lot to get to this week. A lot of NBA news out there right now. Rohan Nadkarni, the great staff writer over at Sports Illustrated, he joins me once again. And we begin with the problems in Boston. The Celtics, one of the most talented teams in the NBA on paper, continue to show inconsistencies and continue to show that maybe there are some significant cracks in that foundation. We get to the Celtics, the Denver Nuggets, we talk about them, DeMarcus Cousins, he's headed back soon to the lineup, and we hand out a handful of our NBA midseason awards. So stick around for that. A little bit later on, Jay Michael, the great beat writer over at the Indianapolis Star, he joins me for a deep dive on the Pacers, one of the more surprising teams in the Eastern Conference, getting contributions from Oladipo, which you'd expect. Miles Turner taking a step forward, Tyreek Evans, his contributions. I talk about all that and more with Jay Michael of the Indianapolis Star. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, back this week on the podcast, Rohan Nadkarni, the staff writer over at Sports Illustrated and SI.com. What's happening, Rohan?
Not much. I just want to apologize to any viewers right off the bat. If Chris is in a bad mood today, it's because I was running a little late.
Okay, so there are no viewers. It's
okay,
a podcast.
That's right.
It's listeners, but we could take this thing video at some point. That could be the next evolution.
It could be a segment on Crossover TV.
Oh, a little self-promotion there.
There it is, yeah.
For Crossover TV. Yeah. I like that. Subscribe to SITV over at SI.com. All right, let's jump right in, Rohan. I'm based in Boston, so I've got a bird's eye view of all the problems right now in Boston. But to start the calendar year, the Celtics went 4-0 on a recent homestand. The offense, it was clicking. The assist numbers were up. I think they had at least four games in a row with 30-plus assists, which is kind of a golden number for NBA coaches. And Boston was starting to look like the team we expected to see before the start of the season. Then came this past week's trip through Florida. They were blown out in Miami. They lost to Orlando. After the loss to the Magic, the veterans, Al Horford and Kyrie Irving, they questioned the effort of the young players on the team once again. So what do you make of the latest twist to the Celtics season?
Okay, first of all, Kyrie Irving turning into the preachy veteran is a development I did not see coming at the start of the season. Frankly, it strikes me as a little hypocritical of Kyrie to be this guy. Let's parse his statement a little bit, right? First, he was questioning the effort of the young guys. He said, you know, what's going to happen when we make the finals? Something along those lines. Those guys almost made it to an Eastern Conference Finals without Kyrie Irving last year, okay?
They almost made an NBA Finals.
Exactly. That's right. That's what I mean. They were one game from the NBA Finals, I should say. That's what I meant to say. So for him to come off and be like, you know, let me teach you guys how to do it. When has Kyrie led a team, you know, without LeBron James to those heights? I mean, this is the kind of stuff he complained about in Cleveland, is it not? He didn't like, you know, being paternalized the way LeBron did, and now he's doing the same thing. It just strikes me as an absurd thing for Kyrie Irving, of all people, to say, frankly. And for the vets to chastise this young core, I mean, Al Horford, I think, has a little bit more authority there, but to me the young guys aren't the problem. The team, again, like, they were great last year. They were one LeBron James away from making the NBA Finals. I'm to the point with the Celtics where I maybe wasn't the biggest believer in them, but I do think things have swung too far the other way. I don't think there's any kind of catastrophic big picture issue there. I mean, sometimes teams don't play well in Florida. I mean, there are reasons why teams don't always play well in Miami. I know that was, I believe, a back-to-back for Boston.
That was a back-to-back, yeah.
But I think right now things are swinging too far the other way. Like you said, they had those four games in a row, 30 straight assists. Offense was looking great. They've been a lot better with this quote-unquote new starting lineup that's not very new anymore. I do think that maybe the the outrage has swung a little bit too far the other way. I think they're going to be fine, but I just don't buy Kyrie Irving as their veteran leader, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, Kyrie's got to have some accountability himself.
I mean, his Cavs teams were notorious for not giving a shit during the regular season. They hardly played defense 2 out of those 3 years that he was teamed up with LeBron. I mean,
I think, and I'm not defending, I don't want to be the Kyrie defender of this because I have some issues with how he's conducted himself and certainly how he's played at times this season. I mean, I was on the broadcast after the game. I don't know if you watched that Orlando game, Rohan. It was interesting towards the end, but there was a moment in that game. I think there was 3.5 minutes left in the game, and the Celtics were charging. It looked like they had the momentum. Orlando looked like they were about to fold. And Kyrie, in transition, Boston down 4, he pulls up for a 27-footer. In transition, with numbers, he pulls up for a 27-footer. Now, I know he's got the perpetual green light with this team, but that to me was a huge momentum swing because the Magic turned around and got 5 unanswered. And that was really the difference in that game. People have pointed to that final play, and we can examine that. There was some dissension there beginning in the huddle where Kyrie looked like he was strongly disagreeing with something to do with the play call. And then the execution of it, of course, was not the way it was supposed to go. But Kyrie killed that drive, that comeback himself. That three-pointer, I was banging my head against the table when I saw that, Rohan, because you go to the basket, you get 2. Kyrie went to the free throw line like 12 times during that game, which is a lot for a guy that's averaging like 3.5 free throws per game this season. You go to the basket, you get fouled, maybe get an and one. You're right in that game, down 2, maybe down 1. That, to me, was a huge one. So I have some issues with how Kyrie's conducted himself. All that being said, there is some pretty clear evidence of a lack of effort on the part of some players on this team. I mean, the Jaylen Brown situation in Miami, that was a lack of effort on the defensive end, getting back in transition that Marcus Morris spotted and Marcus Morris called out. And I think Marcus Morris at this point has enough equity within this team to do stuff like that. I mean, you can certainly argue if you want to run down the most valuable Celtics this year, it's Kyrie Irving 1 and it's Marcus Morris 2. I mean, Marcus Morris is on pace. He might have, Rohan, one of those 90-50-40 seasons. Like, those type of seasons are reserved for, like, the Steve Nashes and Kevin Durants and players of that line. Marcus Morris has a chance to join that club. So he was pissed off, and he said something to Jaylen Brown. That's not the first time that I've heard veterans grumbling at some of the defensive effort from Jaylen Brown. And, you know, Tatum hasn't had the type of year that you expected him to have, maybe. And Terry Rozier has been a bit of a disappointment. I mean, his field goal percentage and his three-point percentage are both down. You expected his scoring to go down, his minutes to go down, his assist numbers maybe to go down. You didn't expect such a tailspin in the field goal percentage there. So there seems to be a pretty reasonably sized divide between the veterans in the locker room and the young players about how this team is playing and maybe who should be playing.
Yeah, it is interesting how I think the biggest Celtics skeptics at the start of the season, it always seemed like a little bit more wishful thinking than anything. It was kind of people being like, well, maybe it all won't work out. And now you're seeing some signs of, it's almost like they're meshing two different teams together, right? There was the team that was in the playoffs last year that was without Kyrie, without Gordon Hayward, that had a good level of success. And now it's this year's team, right? That's trying to work Kyrie and Gordon back, you know, into the roles that they're used to. At the same time, I mean, they're obviously very comfortably in the top 5 of the East. I mean, Miami's not going to catch them for that 5 spot. You know, they're still fairly close within striking range of the Sixers and Bucks of the world. I don't know. I mean, my question to you would be, with all this being said, I mean, what are the consequences, right? Because I still think they're obviously going to make the playoffs. I mean, they still have a very good chance at home court. Like, I mean, I'd be shocked if they got bounced in the first round. You know what I'm saying? Like, what do you think the consequences of this kind of situation are? Because I agree that there are some troubling signs, but what does it really mean to you in the long run?
Well, it's an incomplete grade at this point because we're right around the midway point of the season, and we've seen this team be very Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, they've had games like they had the previous 2. They've also had that 4-game homestand. They also had an 8-0 stretch, I think, in November, December. They've had some great moments, and there still is enough time for them to figure out how to play together. The consequence, though, is if they don't get one of those top 3 seeds, they are ripe for a beating in the second round. Mm. I don't believe right now, as we see these two teams playing out, I don't think they can go to Toronto and win a second round series. I don't. I think last year they lost to the Raptors in Toronto by an average of 19 points per game. And the Raptors are better. They're better than the 59-win team that we saw last season because Kawhi Leonard is a better player than DeMar DeRozan. So I think that's the biggest consequence. If they don't get their act together, they're going to wind up being bounced in the second round, which would be catastrophic for a team that's put together like this. But let me ask you this question. Does this, the first half of the season, does it give you any reason for pause on Kyrie Irving being a long-term fit in Boston? Let me tell you just what, because Kyrie Irving's future is one of the most oft-debated things that I hear about when I go to arenas or talk to different sources across the league. There are people who are like, can say with a high degree of certainty that the Brooklyn Nets are going to get Kyrie Irving and Jimmy Butler. There are people that are saying that. The Nets, Kyrie, Butler, that's it. I was the one that got the ball rolling last June when I brought up the Knicks.
Talking about self-promotion, okay.
Well, I mean, you know, I did a podcast when I was still over at Yahoo with Shams, and we talked about, you know, Kyrie and the fact that Knicks were kind of, they were a realistic destination for him. And I think that's still a possibility, you know, for Kyrie Irving. One of those two Knick teams are possible. And what Kyrie has done is he's put the Celtics in a bit of a box.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, because he said, I'm willing to commit here. But the out that he'll have is if the Celtics don't offer him
the five-year
full max. Now, the Celtics, I don't get the sense the Celtics are going to be reluctant to pay Kyrie, especially with this season being injury-free. And I've said this to you before. There are people in Boston that believe this is Kyrie Irving's most complete season, that offensively he's been great as usual, but his assist numbers have been up. His rebounding numbers, I think, are up, and his defense has been better than it's been in years past. So I don't think they'll have an issue paying him. But if they blink a little bit, that might give Kyrie enough reason to walk away. But that's a roundabout way of asking my question. Should the Celtics have any reason for pause for giving Kyrie that money? Or we know what Terry Rozier has done with this team. He's a younger player. He's a healthier player. Is committing to Terry Rozier a smarter alternative? We also know, by the way, how expensive this team's going to get in the years to come.
This is what it really comes down to, right? Because I think what the Celtics are approaching, and it's something the Sixers kind of approached when they traded for Jimmy Butler, is that at what point do you continue to play for flexibility, and at what point do you commit to a core? Because they can let Kyrie go and say that gives us flexibility to pay another guy, trade for this star, maybe trade Kyrie for more assets, whatever. Or you say, we're going to commit to these guys. We're going to pay X, Y, and Z big money. I don't know that if you're the Celtics, the unknown is better for you right now. If you're telling me that they believe Kyrie Irving's putting together his most complete season, if you still have an opportunity to trade for someone like Anthony Davis, you can dangle someone like Jaylen Brown, whatever, you know, the other assets that you have, I think that's what you do. Because just look at what happened with Philly, right? They were kind of forced into a box when they weren't able to use their cap space on someone. They traded two incredibly useful players for someone who hasn't been a perfect fit. And now they kind of have to trudge along forward when their best laid plans kind of went awry. Boston's been working on this for so long. At some point, the flexibility only gets you so far. You have to get good players, and then you have to find a way to make it work with those good players. They have the pieces right now. They, you know, Gordon Hayward, we're not talking enough about him. He's been a shell of his former self, you know, so far this season.
He's getting better, though.
He's getting better.
He's had his moments,
but when Dwayne Wade in year 16 is credibly guarding Gordon Hayward, I mean, that's kind of when you know there's a little bit of a problem. I'm not saying Gordon Hayward is the problem. I'm saying you could look at it as a glass half full situation. When he gets better, the ceiling of your team is going to go even higher. So I think if you're the Celtics, I wouldn't get rid of Kyrie. I don't know if you negotiate against yourselves. Maybe you don't offer him that fifth year and kind of see what happens. But I just think that when you have good players there, you have the talent in, figure it out, because it's not like you have pieces that don't make sense on paper. I mean, these guys should work. I just think if you get rid of Kyrie, I don't know what talent you're going to get back that's equal to him, you know, just by playing the flexibility game again. I think they have the right pieces there. Why take the risk? Because, you know, free agency trades, all this stuff, people, the general managers can put together the best plans, but they change on the whims of players. So I wouldn't let him go.
Yeah, I don't think you can let him go either. And look, with the understanding that under the most optimal circumstances, there's a risk involved in giving Kyrie Irving 5 years, $190 million, whatever that full max number turns out to be. He is a guy that over the last 3 years has had three knee surgeries. Mm. So, you know, what if at some point those things flare up once again and you wind up paying for past performance? I mean, it hasn't quite become what baseball is, because baseball, you always pay for past performance, right? When you get to, I mean, what the hell is Robinson Cano making right now as he gets traded? I mean, these guys, you know, get these 10-year contracts in their 30s. It's not quite that in basketball, but when you get a guy, and Kyrie's younger than 30, but when he's had those surgeries, when you want to get a guy in his late 20s, you know, slash early 30s, looking for those 5-year contracts, at some point, you're probably going to be paying for past performance there. So there's a risk, but I do think ultimately the Celtics will take that risk. And, you know, we keep doing this, but their end game is still Anthony Davis.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And, you know, maybe these problems can be solved with the dealing with young players by moving all of them at the end of the season to New Orleans for Anthony Davis. That's what they're going to try to do anyway.
Would the Pelicans take Brown right now? I don't know if that's still the most compelling option. Obviously, the Celtics have, you know, up to 4 first-round picks, whatever, but none of them are looking great next year. And with the way the Jaylen Brown stuff is shaking out, I'm really curious who's going to put together the best package, or if some mystery third team is going to swoop in, like Portland or someone, and says, we'll give you, you know, McCollum or something. I'm very curious what the Anthony Davis trade packages are going to look like.
Well, I mean, look, McCollum would be the better player, but I mean, there's a real possibility that Boston could have 4 first-round picks.
But are they enticing enough first-round picks? Here's something I'll say about the McCollum idea. We are kind of seeing a shift in superstar trades, right, where teams just don't want to build for the future anymore. They want to stay competitive.
Are you referring to San Antonio?
I mean, we saw San Antonio, we saw Indiana, we saw Minnesota. They all kind of said, no, we want good players in return, not just flexibility. And for the most part, I mean, it's worked out for those teams.
I think those are just, in a way, distinct circumstances. You know, San Antonio, I think Greg Popovich's age and his desire to win played a factor in all that. Look, there wasn't a massive market for DeMar DeRozan anyway. I mean, it wasn't there. I mean, I had reported in the story in SI that the Raptors looked to flip him for Paul George, you know, around the trade deadline last year. But I think that Popovich's, you know, eagerness to win made him willing to take on a player.
Sure. I'm just saying that I think there's a little bit more proof now for teams who are in the position to trade a superstar that maybe trying to stay competitive has its benefits as opposed to tearing down or rebuilding completely.
Yeah, but if you're New Orleans and you lose Anthony Davis, I'm not sure that, like, Anthony Davis is propping that team up, but they're not even a good team, like, with Anthony Davis. I think if you're New Orleans, it's almost time for a complete tear down and rebuild, mm-hmm. you know, and try to get out of the cap hell that you're dealing with. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, build around Jrue Holiday and maybe CJ McCollum? Is that, what's that going to get you in that market? I think if you can get, you know, Brown and, you know, what if you can get Tatum with it too?
I mean, that's the game changer, right? If they include Tatum, then that's the game changer. But I'm just very interested to see what the package is, what gets reported, because I don't know who has the best one right now.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about a team that's in very good shape at the moment. I tell you what, Rohan, on social media, I get a lot of people that listen to this podcast that wonder why we never talk about the Denver Nuggets. The Denver Nuggets right now, as we speak, are sitting atop the Western Conference standings, not Golden State, not Houston, but your Denver Nuggets. The Nuggets, who missed the playoffs by one game last season, lost that finale to Minnesota, off to the second best start in franchise history. They have a legitimate MVP candidate in Nikola Jokic, who headlines one of the better young cores in all of basketball. This week, they welcome back Will Barton into the lineup, and they're still waiting on the return of Isaiah Thomas, not to mention Gary Harris, one of their key role players, has been in and out of the starting lineup. What have you made, Rohan, of the start of the season for the Denver Nuggets? And are they a real contender in the West?
I've been hugely high on the Nuggets since the preseason, right? I legitimately thought they could make a conference finals as presently constructed. I mean, I was the only SI writer to pick them to make the NBA finals. I mean, that was kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke, but they're very, very good. First and foremost, I just want to commend the front office for keeping Michael Malone in charge there. I think Mike Malone's done an awesome job with this team. You could tell those guys really love playing for him. They could have made kind of a rash decision and fired him after they didn't make the playoffs last year. I think they understood he was dealing with a lot of injuries. There are so many good things about this team, right? First, let me start with the backcourt, Jamal Murray and Gary Harris. If Gary Harris played in the East, I think he would be an all-star starter. That's how good he is. That's the level of talent he has. Same goes for Jamal Murray. I think in 2 or 3 years, they have a chance to be the second best backcourt in the Western Conference. I mean, frankly, they're on their way there right now. Nikola Jokic, as you said, MVP candidate. What they've done on the defensive end this year, they're not a top five unit like they were for much of the start of the season, but they've improved so much. And I give credit to Jokic. He might not be a great defender, but he's a willing defender. You see the way he's chasing guards when they're trapping on pick and rolls. The way everyone else moves around him to cover for him is incredible. I'm just such a fan of this team. The way the role players have stepped up, Monte Morris, who was a two-way guy for them last year, has an absurd assist-to-turnover ratio. It is making a great case for Sixth Man of the Year. Malik Beasley, who stepped in for Gary Harris numerous times amongst, you know, Harris's injury struggles. Beasley, you saw him playing defense one-on-one against Damian Lillard in that thrilling win over Portland last night. He's been an outstanding. Torrey Craig starting for them. Juancho Hernan Gomez hitting threes. I mean, they're just getting contributions from everyone on the roster. They have a legit MVP talent in Jokic. You know, two ascending studs in Murray and Harris. I'm super high on this team. I think they're for real. Listen, do I think they can beat Golden State this year? No. I mean, that's a team that hasn't even been through a playoff series together. Do I think they can make a conference finals and make it a little interesting? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you ran the gamut there with all their guys, and you're right about all of them. I mean, I like, you know, people talk to me about Toronto and why the Raptors are good, you know, it's Kawhi and it's Lowry, but I point to the Siakams and the Van Vliets and the OG Anunobis. That's Monty Morris, who was a two-way player last year, and now he's stepped into this lineup and been a key role player for this team. The biggest surprise to me with Denver is how the hell did they become a good defensive team. Like last year, they were like bottom five. Like, they were terrible at defense. This year, there are a number of major defensive categories. They're right at the top in. And, you know, a lot of the guys are the same from last season. They've had some guys come back and be healthy, but their defense being a high-level defensive unit is the biggest surprise. The wild card for me is as far as how deep the Nuggets can go in the playoffs, it's got to be Jamal Murray. And just how well can Jamal Murray play in a series where he's matched up with, like, Lillard in one series and Steph Curry in another series or Russell Westbrook in another series. This is a point guard on the rise. I mean, he is a terrific young player, but what can you expect from a player like that at a key position in the postseason? That's something I wonder about. Everything else, like, I think Jokic is the real deal. Like, he's going to be solid in the postseason. I think their depth is going to be okay in the postseason. And if their defense holds up, look, they're a great passing team. You know, I mentioned earlier, 30 is kind of the magic assist number for NBA coaches and, you know, and how well you play in offensively in a game. They've done it 13 times this season. They're number two in the NBA in assists per game. So they're going to get it done, you know, from different spots on the floor. But, you know, push comes to shove when you got to get a stop or you got to have someone make a big play. That's probably going to be Jamal Murray. And I wonder, in a postseason series for the first time, is he going to be able to pull that off?
It's going to be interesting. Two things to your point. I mean, Jamal Murray, again, I picked him before the season for our season preview as my surprise player. I was kind of expecting him to take a leap. I think he can definitely score with all those guards you mentioned. That's something I'm not worried about. He has that confidence. I mean, they played Sacramento a couple weeks ago, and he had a gigantic second half. I mean, this is a guy who I think loves getting in people's faces. I think a playoff environment he'll thrive in, because I think he loves competition. He loves those rivalries. I mean, you see him kind of going after opposing point guards. I think he's going to rise to the occasion in a situation like that. I think the playoffs are made for players like Jamal Murray. I will say, to their defense, I mean, I watch the Nuggets a lot. They're not doing anything radical scheme-wise. I mean, they trap guys coming off pick and rolls. They kind of let Jokic run around. You got to give so much credit to guys like Paul Millsap, Gary Harris, Malik Beasley, guys who are, you know, having to play defend 3-on-4, stuff like that, 4-on-5, numerous times when Jokic is kind of sucked into a pick and roll. And they do a great job of rotating. I mean, Paul Millsap is such an important part of that team. I mean, he's having a low scoring year, and he can be frustrating to watch offensively at times, but Paul Millsap is so important to that team offensively. I mean, they just have guys who are really playing for each other on the defensive end, covering for each other, and that does go a long way.
Yeah, there's interesting a team in the NBA. Mike Malone has done an unreal job. Tim Conley, who, you know, people were killing Tim a couple of years ago when he made that, was it last year? No, 2 years ago when he made that Plumlee for Nurkic trade, had to throw in the first round pick. You know, Nurkic has been really good in Portland. That's a separate topic, but, you know, Plumlee's been good. Do you see Plumlee and Jokic running the big man pick and roll?
Plumlee's really, you know, that contract got derided, but he's really been a very solid backup big for him. And another thing, something that I think is remarkable about the Nuggets is some, you know, I get texts from people sometimes, how can Jokic be an MVP candidate if Plumlee comes in for him defensively at the end of games? And it, to me, that's an even bigger credit to Jokic. You know who shouldn't be playing in a key defensive possession at the end of a game? James Harden. But Mike D'Antoni could never take him out, right? I think that says something about Jokic, that he understands, hey, listen, put in the better defensive center for this incredibly important possession. I think, yeah, Plumlee's been really, really good for them. He was important for them when Millsap was hurt. I mean, I really like Tim Connelly. I mean, I did a story on the Nuggets last year. I remember Tim Connelly just telling me straight to my face, yeah, it was luck. Pure luck. That's how he described Nikola Jokic's development. And I think they've done a great job building what, you know, all their guys are incredibly young. Gary Harris is the oldest of their core, and he's 24 years old. They're going to be good for a long time.
Yeah, Jokic checked none of the boxes that you traditionally look for in a NBA prospect. Just didn't have the athleticism, the shot blocking. I mean, then he gets the NBA, and all those skills kind of come together. So he was one of the best second round picks of all time. You know, he's looking like a perennial MVP candidate who could be, you know, I was reading some stuff that, you know, he's online to, or in, on the path to maybe becoming the greatest Nugget ever. So he's been something for them. All right. A little bit later on this week, we expect to see DeMarcus Cousins make his debut in the Golden State lineup. Cousins, of course, has been out all year, rehabbing that Achilles injury he suffered last year, right around this time, you know, about 11 months ago, while playing for the New Orleans Pelicans. He surprised everybody this offseason when he signed a one-year, $5 million deal with Golden State, theoretically just to kind of get a ring before he enters the offseason to get big money this summer. So what should realistic expectations, Rohan, be for DeMarcus Cousins over the final 3 months in Golden State?
First of all, I'm a little upset Boogie's waited this long to make his debut, because I'm going to be in a flight to Bombay, I think, when he finally checks into an NBA game again. Here's what I'll say about Boogie. As far as realistic expectations go, it's obviously not the same thing as Gordon Hayward, the much different injury, but that should at least kind of stop us from getting too far ahead of ourselves. I think Boogie's obviously immensely talented player, but we've now seen firsthand, even when you have a superstar and it's a team with other star-level talents, it could take them a little while to get going. And you know Steve Kerr especially is not going to put any pressure on him. He's going to slow play it. The thing I'm most interested to see about Boogie on the Warriors is there going to be a point where he takes Draymond's minutes? Now, we know Draymond is incredibly important to what that team does defensively. You know, people can point to some numbers of his that are slipping. He's not defending as well at the rim anymore, all that kind of stuff. His switchability, everything Draymond does is still so important to that team's identity defensively. But the way teams are ignoring him on offense, I'm most curious to see, is Boogie going to take some minutes from Draymond? Are they going to close with Boogie in the last 2 minutes of the game? Who's going to be on the floor? That's the kind of stuff, maybe not one game in, but you know, after a month or so, I'm most excited to see with Cousins, kind of how are they deploying him in high leverage situations?
Yeah, I with any injury, it takes time to work your way back into the mix. This is a significant injury, you know, for a big man. Maybe more so for a guard who has got to move around a little bit more. But for a big man, you know, you're not going to have your explosiveness. You're not going to have your burst. Maybe you get it back at some point, but I think it's going to be, you know, maybe another calendar year before we see the real Boogie Cousins. Fortunately, you don't need the real Boogie Cousins in Golden State. What you need is a shot blocker. What you need is a rebounder. And you may not even need him to be that for more than 15 minutes a game. I mean, there are reports out there now that that there are issues between Robin Lopez and the Bulls. You know, Robin Lopez wants a buyout. We've known that for a little while. The Golden State Warriors want him. We've known that for a little while as well. The Bulls seem to not be willing to play ball here, but that could just be posturing at this point. If the Warriors get Robin Lopez as well, or somebody else that plays that position, that minimizes the need for Cousins even more. So I don't think he needs to be anything more than a 10 to 15 minute per game player who can maybe give them some post touches, maybe increases their rebounding. Right now, they're very thin in the middle. You know, the loss of JaVale McGee and some of the injuries they've had, that has left them paper thin. So a big body would be valuable, but they don't need more than just a part-time player, Rohan, in that spot.
Without a doubt. And it's really of no risk to the Warriors, right? Because if at any point he's not playing well or he's not meshing or the defense isn't living up to expectations, just take him off the floor and you're still far, far away the most talented team in the NBA. So I think Kerr's going to take his time. I don't think there's going to be any fireworks. I don't think we're going to, you know, maybe towards the end of the regular season we'll get to see some great boogie games, but I think for the Warriors, they understand having him is an ultimate luxury, and, you know, it might not be until the playoffs when they decide they really need to unleash him. I think Kerr is going to just take his time with it because he doesn't need to do anything else. There's no reason for him to put any pressure, any burden on Boogie's shoulders until they absolutely need it.
What do you think that the rest of the season, how closely do you think teams are going to be monitoring what Cousins does? Do you think it's consequential at all for how much money he's going to get this offseason? I mean, I would imagine they'd like to see him healthy, but I don't think anyone's really expecting him to be the old Boogie Cousins over the last next 3 months.
Something that is funny to me, because as much as we talk about 2019 free agency and how big the class is, Boogie never gets talked about as maybe one of the stars that could help your franchise. Like, what team has been connected to Boogie? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't heard any, you know, I understand you, Chris Mannix, got the ball rolling about Kyrie to the Knicks, but I haven't heard anyone get the ball rolling about DeMarcus's next landing spot. I don't know that any team can pick up great information from his Warriors center. Like you said, I don't think he's going to play big minutes. I don't think he's going to all of a sudden transform into a different player in the playoffs either. But I'm very interested to see who he ends up with, because there are so many teams looking for a star. They're going to strike out on Kevin Durant, on Klay Thompson, that isn't going to trade for Anthony Davis. You know, are the Nets in play for Boogie Cousins? Like, who's the team that's targeting him? I don't know, and I don't think they can learn a lot from his Warriors stint, to be honest.
Where Cousins, I think, is going to make his money is kind of the consolation prize for the teams that lose out on Durant, yeah, and, you know, maybe Kyrie and Jimmy Butler and some of the A-list free agents that are out there. He has a chance to get a long-term deal, you know, if he shows he's healthy. And look, he's probably gonna have an opportunity to show he's healthy into June. So it's basically half a year he's going to have to showcase what he can do out there on the floor, which has to be a net positive for him. All right, before we go, let's talk midseason awards for a second. There are some awards, Rohan, that are kind of sewn up here. I mean, we know that Luka Doncic is Rookie of the Year. Like, he's, barring a major injury, maybe even if with one right now, it seems like he's a lock for that one. But there's a few others I think are more up in the air. Let's start with the MVP, where I think there are a handful of legitimate candidates. Give me your first half MVP.
This is definitely a little bit of recency bias, but I think I'm going to go with James Harden just because of what he's done in the wake of Chris Paul's injury, taking the Rockets from 14th in the West, you know, back up into the top half of the bracket. The way he's done it, just historic offensive output. Obviously, Giannis has just as much claim to the award, but I think what the Rockets are doing in the West and the way Harden has done it has just been so absurd that it has to be Harden for me right now.
Yeah, my only issue with Harden, and it's not recency bias on his, 1-for-17 against the Magic this week from three-point range and still had like 38 points or something. That's one of the weirder stat lines I've ever seen. His usage rate is off the charts. He's just a tick below Russell Westbrook's record-breaking usage rate from that 16-17 season.
I remember writing on Christmas Day, like, he's doing a better Russell Westbrook than Russell Westbrook did, because his usage rate is absurd, but at least he can shoot threes, and, like, you know, he's kind of doing a better Russell Westbrook than Russell Westbrook.
I would think if the Rockets were at the top of the Western Conference standings, I would give it to Houston. But right now they're kind of battling for playoff position there. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'd give it to Harden, but right now they're still battling for playoff position. I lean towards Giannis.
Okay.
at this point. You know, Giannis has another weird stat line. He's shooting 17.2% from three this year. That's well off even last year's mediocre 30-ish percent pace and just a tick above his career worst, which I think came during his second year. He's still putting up monster numbers and in being incredibly effective when he is a non-factor from beyond the three-point line. I can't think of an MVP that wasn't like a Shaq-type big man that has been this ineffective from beyond the three-point line. Like that, I guess
Giannis is that. Like a Shaq-type big man now is what it comes down to, the way he just dominates in the paint.
He shoots the three.
He does. But it's just, we're not used to seeing someone like him play a paint game like he does, but he's much more like a Shaq than anyone else.
Yeah, he just plays off the dribble, though.
It's crazy.
And Giannis wants to be a three-point shooter. He's averaging, you know, the most threes in his career per game. You know, he's averaging 2.5 threes per game right now. So he wants to be a three-point shooter. They just don't go in. Like, he's just 17.2%. Even Westbrook during that MVP year, and Westbrook's not a three-point shooter, but even Westbrook shot 35%, you know, as the MVP in 16-17. So he was right up there. But Giannis at 26, 27 points per game, a lot of the other numbers are great. He has, you know, a chance. He's going to be a double-double guy, but he could be average 6-7 assists per game. Mm-hmm. He's up around 6 right now. And if the Bucks continue to rise in the standings and finish either in first in the East or at number 2, you know, very close to first in the East, I'm going to lean towards him at this point. I think Kawhi's got a chance to make a case of the second half of the season, and I think Paul George has a pretty good chance to make a case in the second half of the season.
All good names you brought up.
Yeah. All right. Most improved player is always one of my more. It's a weird award to look at because voters often have different criteria. Some voters, and I had this argument with Ian Thompson, my former colleague over at SI for years. You know, he liked to vote for, you know, young players that made a big jump. You know, young guys, whether it was Dwight Howard making a big jump. When he was a younger guy. I tend to go in a different direction where I look at guys that weren't expected to be good that in year 3, 4, 5 became really, really good. That to me is more the definition of most improved. So give me your most improved before I give you mine.
I have several guys that could get this award, so I'm just going to go with the homer pick. I'm going to go Justice Winslow right now. What he's done since taking over point guard. I mean, who had him as a point guard entering the NBA? You know, when Goran Dragic went out, he's been the Heat's starting point guard. Just unreal production from him. I mean, he's had a string of 20-point games, you know, assist-to-turnover ratio somewhere close to 2.56. He's just been outstanding. Him at point guard changes that conversation around the Heat's future. That's how good he's been. They've gone from very bleak to now intriguing because you can kind of squint and say, how good can Justice Winslow become if this point guard stuff is for real? And he's been doing it for a long stretch now. His play there, his finishing at the rim, his shooting, just all things that early in his career were huge question marks. He's found answers for them this season. And that team was below 500 for so long. I think at some point 7 games below 500. And they've completely turned around since unleashing him at point guard. So I'm going to go with Justice Winslow for now.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one, and it fits kind of my criteria for the unexpected. Mm-hmm. Even though Justice Winslow was a lottery pick.
Yes.
And I tend to exclude the lottery picks. That's why De'Aaron Fox to me is not most improved.
Okay.
Julius Randle to me is not most improved. Jamal Murray is not.
Okay.
Most improved.
Okay. Get to your pick. We got this. We got the setup.
I'm just building towards it. There's no clock on a podcast here, Rohan. Come on. I'm going Montrezl Harrell with the Clippers.
Okay.
You know, a guy that showed improvement last year in his first year in L.A., but has really taken off. He's one of, not the top field goal percentage leader. He's giving you 15, 16 points per game. When Houston drafted him, I thought that was a draft steal because they got him in the second round. And Montrezl Harrell was one of those productive college players.
Yeah.
And I thought his game would, you know, it was one of those picks where I'm like, this guy did a lot in college. We're not going to give him a look and higher than a, you know, mid-second round pick, that we're not going to look at him as something more than that. It's taken him some time, and he's on his second team, but he's finally getting it, and he's been just a godsend for that Clipper bench right now. So I'm going with Montrezl Harrell.
Yeah, I mean, Trez flashed a bit when he was on the Rockets. I mean, when Capella went down a couple years, he had some big games. I think that he fits the modern NBA really well. I'm happy for him. I think that's a good pick. He's been really, really good.
Yeah, he's averaging 16 points per game right now while shooting 63% from the floor. He did have a pretty good second year, you pointed out, with the Nuggets, where he averaged about 9 points per game. But the last 2 years, the Clippers, he played 76 games that second year, only played about 17 minutes per game, but gave you 11 points.
Yeah.
And this year, he's up to 25 minutes and giving you 15.8. So his numbers and looking at his...
And max effort whenever he's on the floor.
Max effort. I mean, look, his per 36 numbers, I know they're not everything, but you know, 23 points... we're looking at his numbers. To 10 rebounds. So he's, you give him minutes and he produces, you know, for this team this year. So that's my most improved. Finally, coach of the year. This is an easy one for me. I want to see if you're on the same page as I am.
Yeah, I still don't know the phrase. I guess open and shut door case. What's the phrase? I'm not from
the
this
case
country.
Is open and shut. Yes.
All right. It's an open and shut case. It's Mike Malone.
Yeah.
In the first place, Denver Nuggets. What he's done is incredible. And I mean, I've heard from guys around the team this year, he seems a little bit more gruff, maybe is the word. I don't know, that he's kind of understanding the gravity of the situation, but he's pushed the right button every time for this team. And for them to be first in the West, with all the injuries they've had, Will Barton since the second game of the season, Gary Harris missing a good chunk of time, Paul Millsap, that's 3/5 of their starting lineup. He's got to be a runaway winner for this award.
Yeah, he's just a lock. And look, that, you know, Mike Malone has been considered a coach on the rise for some time. Look, he got pretty well screwed in Sacramento.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, he was the only guy in years
who connected with Boogie.
Yeah, connected with Boogie. He was the guy that Boogie got along with out there, and he seemed like they were trending in the right direction. Got fired, you know, for some bizarre reasons, but it's Sacramento and they tend to do stuff like that. You know, he gets hired in Denver, and he has been not only, I think, a good X's and O's coach, but a good developmental coach. I mean, this is a young team with a lot of young pieces that need to be kind of groomed. And you look at from the top down, from Jokic to Murray to Gary Harris, they just keep getting better and better. And he's going to welcome back at some point a player that he had a very strong relationship with before in Isaiah Thomas. So I don't know what Isaiah is going to be capable of with that team, but you know, if he's anything like the player we've seen in years past, that's going to be an upgrade for that bench in the second half of the season.
I want to say this to your point about Michael Malone as a development coach. Again, I remember spending time in Denver last year, and something he said in that piece that really stuck out to me was Mike Malone was a coach in Cleveland when LeBron was there. He was a coach in Golden State, you know, early in Stephen Clay's career. And I remember him telling me, you know, Stephen Clay weren't the Splash Brothers from day one. They weren't Stephen Clay from day one. They turned into those guys. And he said, why can't Nikola Jokic turn into an MVP candidate? Why can't Gary and Jamal turn into all-stars? And look at what's happened. He told me that a year ago, last, you know, November 2017, and look at what's happened. Nikola Jokic has turned into an MVP candidate. Jamal Murray has turned into an all-star candidate in the backcourt. He had faith in those guys. He had faith in his developmental staff, and he's been proven right. So I'm happy for him.
Yeah, that's an easy one, and a handful of tough ones, but an easy one right there. Rohan, always appreciate your time, man. Enjoy the vacation. India, is that where you're going?
That's right, man. I'm going home, baby.
Going home. That's it's usually a good time for an NBA writer to go home middle of January.
I mean, before the All-Star break, the league's in a lull. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, nothing going on now. Like, not just the trade deadline.
Oh my God, here, you know, you're the one hitting the slopes every weekend.
I hit the slope for like one day every 2 weeks. All right.
That's honestly weird. I'm going to say it. That's
2 hours
weird.
From my house. Come on.
God. Dude, I can't believe you snow. It's, oh God.
Okay. That wasn't even English, but it's all right.
I just, every time I think about you getting on a snowboard, my mind is blown.
It's not the prettiest sight because I am 6'3", and it's...
Don't brag about your height now,
how
also.
How is that bragging?
Was a brag. That was an...
Snowboarding is, generally speaking, I found a easier sport for people a little bit shorter. It just is because,
oh my God,
lower to the ground.
So now, not only are you telling everyone how tall you are, you're saying that there's an added level of difficulty for you to become a good snowboarder.
It's like anything else. It's like if you're, I'm trying to think of another sport that's easier based on size. Like it just is. There's some sports. It's like being a quarterback in football. You're better if you're taller, generally speaking.
God damn, man. You are okay. A fascinating individual.
Let's just end this before it gets completely out of hand. Enjoy your trip, Rohan, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, man.
When we come back, my conversation with Pacers beat writer Jay Michael. All right, one of the more interesting teams in the Eastern Conference right now is the Indiana Pacers, right in the mix, threatening to land one of those top four seeds in the Eastern Conference. They've got a bona fide star in Victor Oladipo, a deep bench. How far can they go? What do we make of these Pacers for that? Bring in Jay Michael. Does a great job covering the Pacers for the Indianapolis Star. Jay, what's up, man?
Hey, nothing much. This is a pretty interesting team. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we start with the end of last year, okay, where Indiana gave Cleveland a run for their money. You know, a few things go their way. Some shots go their way. Maybe they beat the Cavs in the first round. They come back this year, and to my eyes, they look like a much different team. I mean, they're still led by Oladipo, but there's, it feels to me there's more of a depth to them now with Sabonis playing the way he is and, you know, some of the guys coming off the bench. Where is this team to you this year in comparison to where they were at the end of last year?
Miles Turner. Just signed that extension before the season for $80 million. So we had a lot of pressure on him, and there was a lot of questions. Could he take it to the next level? Because last year was pretty underwhelming. They were able to do what they did last year with Miles Turner being kind of so-so most of the time. And so he had the pressure on him to perform up to the contract. Could he be the rim protector that they wanted? And he has been that and then some. I mean, as good as Indiana can be defensively, there are times if you watch him play, say, Atlanta, a team they've beaten three times, but stylistically gives them trouble. Toronto, they're vulnerable against teams like that. But the one thing that kind of keeps them afloat when all things are breaking down is Miles Turner, because they get beat off the dribble. He's protecting the rim and being that guy defensively that they've been looking for. And on the flip side of it, he's become offensively. If you look at his numbers to start the season, he was shooting somewhere around 25% on unguarded shots, which is hard to believe. And he was kind of, I think, thinking it through too much. And now if you look at the way he's scoring on the mid-range, and now he's popping for threes more, in particularly in the corners, an area that he's never shot well from. And it's kind of added another dimension to the offense. So defensively, I think he's helped them become a better team. And offensively, he's given them more versatility to where you don't need Oladipo to score 25, 30 a night to win.
He's complemented, I think, pretty well by Sabonis, who is one of the most efficient players that I've seen in the last few years. Where is he taking a step forward to you?
I think his passing has been better than I anticipated coming into this year. I mean, quite frankly, his passing has been better than I expected. Bojan Bogdanovic's passing has been better than it had been the previous year. Sabonis is pretty much a guaranteed double-double off the bench, which is saying something. And there was this narrative going into the season, well, it has to be either or, Sabonis and Miles Turner, which isn't true because their strengths are completely different. If you need 2 points to tie a game or a 2-point bucket maybe to win a game, I guess, and you think you have an advantage inside the paint, Sabonis is your guy. If you think you want to use a spread big to kind of open the floor a little bit to give you more options, not only for the jump shot or to open it up for, you know, guys like Oladipo to drive, you use Miles Turner because it's going to draw more respect from the defense. So I think that's the other part of this, where they've kind of went to this other level, that you can have both guys, because it's almost against the grain in NBA that you have two bigs like that. People have gone so much smaller, but you can have two bigs with those two guys, and they have variety. Their strengths and weaknesses are different. Sabonis's weaknesses defensively, particularly when he has to step outside, Miles Turner is better at that. Posting up, Sabonis is better at that. Facing up, from range, Miles Turner's better at that.
Is the chemistry between those two better this year than it was at the end of last year?
No doubt. They didn't necessarily play well together all the time because it was one of them was going to be at a disadvantage because one would have to defend away from the rim. And I think Turner has gotten better at doing that. I mean, I go back to when they played Phoenix earlier this season. And, you know, granted, Phoenix isn't a great team, but Devin Booker's a pretty good player. And it was in crunch time of the game, and Turner got caught on a switch on Devin Booker out at the arc. And he forced him into a turnover, defended him quite well. If you had Sabonis in that position, for instance, he's probably going to get beat, and it's going to force a rotation, and, you know, you end up with an open look somewhere. So I think the way they play off each other this year, you see McMillan using both of them more often now. He rarely used them in combination last year. He uses them a lot more this year.
Sabonis is just so sturdy. That's the word I'd use for him, sturdy. Just he can't move him off his spot. He's going to get there, and he's so fundamentally sound that it's – he's just a great role player to have. I wonder how much he's going to cost down the line.
Yeah,
but he's a great role player to have on your team. Yeah. On the flip side, and you know, look, Victor Oladipo is still a light years better than I think Indiana expected from the player they got from Oklahoma City. But efficiency's down. You know, the 3-point shooting, the overall field goal percentage. Is that a byproduct of teams, you know, kind of loading up on him? Is there more to his lack of efficiency this year?
I think they've loaded up on him a lot more, and you've seen late in games now, the adjustments that they've made, the game that they just recently had against Chicago, you know, how I think he's playing more intelligently and he's not forcing shots. But when I go back to that Chicago game, I think it was even the Knicks, when they played the Knicks at one point earlier this season, he anticipated the trap correctly, got the ball out early, and got open shots for Bogdanovich against New York. He missed it, but it ended up leading to a rebound and a made shot to win the game. And against Chicago, similar situation. Oladipo gets a big guy in isolation. It was Laurie Markkanen. Took him off the dribble immediately, beats him to the rim. Next time down the court, they flatten out. He's at the top of the key. He correctly anticipates. They're probably going to blitz him with a double team because what he just did to Markkanen. And he gets rid of the ball, and it leads to Miles Turner hitting an open three to tie the game in overtime. And then the next time down the floor, similar situation, Miles Turner slides the screen. They think a screen's coming. He slides it and allows Oladipo to go one-on-one against Chris Dunn. And he pulls up and hits a big-time three-point bank shot, even against the Celtics earlier this year. Comes down, doesn't go for two, goes for three. So even though his efficiency is down, I think his ability and willingness to still take those big shots in moments when the game hasn't been a great game for him, I think his confidence hasn't wavered, and he still is willing and able to hit that shot. But no doubt his efficiency is down. He had a knee injury that caused him to miss 11 games. I'm sure that has a little bit to do with some of the efficiency as well. But
he was playing like an MVP candidate right before that injury.
Yeah, he was. And so, I mean, the good news is, like we just talked about Sabonis, Miles Turner. I mean, to me, Corey Joseph's been an unsung hero off the bench. So they have all these other elements that's coming into place to help fill in some of those gaps. And I think when it comes to playoff time, ultimately you're still going to need a guy like Oladipo in the game. He's going to have the ball. Whether he's going to make the shot and make the right read, he's going to be your guy regardless. If he's gone 0 for 20 in the game, he's going to be the decision maker. And I don't see – the guy is so – I've been around guys who are clearly miffed about how they're not shooting well or playing well, and sometimes you see him force it too much. I still don't get the sense that he forces it, and as a result of that, I think he's going to be okay long term.
So why'd you bring up Corey Joseph? Why is he the young son hero for?
Because he had a 0 point game. It's about 2 weeks ago, back in December, and he was the best player on the floor. He jams the ball when it comes to he usually defends the best offensive guard on the floor. Even against Boston, that first game in which they played the Celtics at Bankers Life, he was the guy in late, not Darren Collison, defending Kyrie Irving. And if you look at the switch that he made with Oladipo, they didn't switch. They tried to create a switch, and how he fights through the screen, stays with the man, and he forced Kyrie to miss once down a stretch, and then they blew up the final play to create the turnover to win that game. Corey Joseph does all the dirty stuff that you don't see on a stat sheet. When I talk about they have trouble with fast teams with guards who are really like Trae Young, who's, you know, is a rookie who can light you up. You see Corey Joseph when Trae Young, for instance, is off the ball, being physical with him. He won't let him get the ball back. You don't always necessarily see that with Darren Collison, and I think that's where sometimes you see Collison get put on the bench the rest of the game because his ball pressure and his off-ball pressure isn't good enough. Corey Joseph does all of those sorts of things, and McMillan is so big on defense, it's hard for me to see a scenario where he doesn't find a way to get Corey Joseph 20 minutes a game, because Corey Joseph, to me, is at the core of the identity of what McMillan wants this team to be. So and the other thing he does too, other than defense, Chris, the pace of the game, sometimes they have issues with pace. Collison's not doing it correctly. Tyreek Evans is being too ball dominant and just sucking the air out of it. You see Corey Joseph is pressure offense. There's no doubt that's that Greg Popovich San Antonio thing. Just constantly, you know, they shut him off. He keeps his dribble alive. He goes back into the pick and roll. He makes him flip the screen roll. And he just constantly puts pressure on guys to make them break. And if he doesn't hit the shot, he kind of creates a pace and he gets them into their offense much quicker. And that's where, you know, when you look at why the Pacers are so good now, when they could have struggled early, there are times when Collison and Tariq Evans have been completely not playing good basketball. And Corey Joseph, whether he only had 2 or 3 points, maybe at 10 points, he was the reason why that offense got into high gear because he kind of took them to another level. He's an unsung guy.
What about Tyreek Evans? When he signed with Indiana, I thought that was kind of one of the underappreciated offseason moves because I love what he was doing for a while in Memphis. That was a weird situation down there. What have you seen from him with this team?
It's hot and cold with him. I mean, I think part of what he has to do is he's getting used to how Nate McMillan wants him to play. He wants him to give up the ball early and then worry about getting
it
back.
That's never been Tyreek Evans.
That's never been his game. And that's the funny thing. Like, I was talking to John Calipari earlier this season, and we were kind of talking about, like, how even when you go to high school, you know, these guys who, you know, they're only playing 1 year of college. You don't have a whole lot of time to kind of remake their game. So they come to the pros with bad habits. And, of course, one of Tyreek's worst habits is he can be so ball dominant. It can be a good thing and a bad thing. If he's hitting his shots, it's a great thing. But when he's not hitting his shots, he's playing in traffic, he's forcing up the ball in difficult situations, it's not a great thing. So I think part of it is he has to adjust because he's never been on a team that's required this sort of discipline from him. That's something Thaddeus Young told me. He said Tyreek told him, like, I have never had to deal with a situation where a team was this on point and this detailed about everything. So I think it's a culture adjustment for him. But I think when it comes to the playoffs, when it comes to crunch time, I think you're going to see Tyreek, as things start, we start to get closer, I think he's going to play better. He'll have his moments when he's really good, and his other moments, like I said, you'll say, wow, what was that? But they need shot makers, and that's what they didn't have against Cleveland. If you had Tyreek instead of Lance Stephenson, because Tyreek is a better offensive option, you probably win that series in 7 games rather than lose it in 7 games. And I think that's the thinking with his acquisition. But he's a 6'6 guy, big physical body. Defensively, by the way, he's been far better than I've ever seen him play in his entire NBA career. And I think a lot of that has to do with the demands that Nate McMillan puts on him.
I'm shocked that Sacramento and Memphis didn't show the type of discipline that Tyreek Evans was used to or seeing here in Indiana. So Nate McMillan. Great month of December. Nate McMillan wins Coach of the Month, deservedly so. I've run hot and cold on Nate McMillan over the years, and that Cleveland series was a great example of it. Pacers right there, but it used to drive me crazy, Jay, watching the offense kind of devolve to Victor Oladipo backing up to half court and just sort of power driving down the lane. I just, you know, I wondered if they would have won that series if they could do a little more. How much credit do you give Nate McMillan for where this team is right now, and how have you seen him kind of grow as a coach over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Nate does is a little bit counterintuitive to what you see a lot of teams do, which is, you know, put up a lot of high-volume threes and that sort of thing. And you see with Nate,
Nate should coach Russell Westbrook. Like, that's, like, offensively, like, that's Russell Westbrook's game. Like, straight downhill. Like, Nate should coach offense of Russell Westbrook.
I mean, there are fair criticisms to the way – I mean, I think their space and still – isn't what it always needs to be. I think there are situations or matchups where he could use Kyle O'Quinn. I mean, Kyle O'Quinn's been a victim, for instance, to the numbers game because you have three bigs and, you know, it's kind of hard to get minutes for three bigs. But there have been times where there have been bad matchups for other guys, and I thought O'Quinn might have been a better matchup because he's a good passer from the high post and he's a better passer than Miles Turner. And so you could definitely question some adjustments, some spacing issues. I'm still not crazy about Thad Young. He hasn't done it as much, but he had been spacing to the three-point line a lot. And, look, teams are going to give you that shot. They're going to bait him into that shot. And I think sometimes that's when their offense kind of hits a rut. But Nate, for the most part, he believes in simple, smart basketball, attacking mismatches. You have a guard defending Thad Young in a post, go to it. You have a guard defending Sabonis in a post, which you see a lot of teams switching, go at it. I just think when they got off to a little slow start early this season, you saw Miles Turner in that position. And even with posting up smaller guys, that's not his strength. And teams are willing to risk that. So, and they've kind of gotten away from that. So I think he's adjusted this year better And we've seen Miles probably after that first month facing up more, which is what he's more comfortable with. He can even, you know, he can develop into a better post player, but you can't really force something square into something round right now. So I think he's adjusted in that regard. But, you know, I said Tyreke Evans has played the better best defense I've ever seen him play this year. I didn't expect a lot of defense out of Doug McDermott. He's played significantly better, way better than I ever anticipated. And, you know, McMillan has something to do with that. It has to do with the demands of not having guys just chuck up shots and run down the court and not worry about defense. So I think Nate is evolving. But, look, they still have a ways to go, I think, offensively, because they still have issues where they bog down and the pace comes out of the game. And I think, again, I think a lot of that has to do with some of the spacing issues that you see on the court.
So this is, you know, as we talk now, they're right there in the mix, can get a top four seed, maybe even climb into that three spot if they make a run in the second half. But when you talk to people internally there, I mean, what are their expectations, you know, for this season? Do they feel like this team has enough talent and should have enough talent to build on from what they did last mm-hmm. year, win a series? What's their mindset, not just this year, but I guess over the next 2 years?
They think they should win a series this year, a top four seed this year. I picked them to finish fourth in the East. I thought maybe, given the way Milwaukee's been playing, maybe fifth seed is what they're going to end up with. They believe they have a legitimate shot at a top two seed. Maybe that's being a little bit too ambitious on their part, but it's reasonable when you see how the Eastern Conference is shaken out. So they expect to advance in the playoffs this year. To not advance would be a failure of a season, and because that would not show any progress. You know, you bring in Tyreke, you bring in Doug, you have more offense, you're still good defensively. They should have better results. So the expectation is that they at least advance this season, and that they can have a chance to make a more significant dent in free agency, which has always been a problem spot for the Pacers. You know, you always talk about you got to be able to win, you got to have show veterans and quality players who are free agents that you can give them something that they've been missing in their career. They want to be able to do that so they can make a viable run at some big name, not necessarily a superstar name, but some significant free agents. Because if you look at the list of free agents that they've lured, but the last 25 years, I mean, it's like David West, Tyreke Evans, and who else? Like, it's not a whole lot.
I like that about them, though, to a degree. Because every time, when you have a smaller market team, oftentimes you have to overpay.
Yeah.
And how many times does that ever really work out? I mean, we're just seeing what happened with Chandler Parsons in Memphis.
Yes,
like, I mean,
exactly.
You know, sometimes, what's that phrase? Discretion's the better part of valor there.
Yeah.
Like, just back off. You know, just you know, keep trying to build organically. I mean, it's tough. But if you keep hitting on draft picks,
yes.
and they've done a reasonably good job with those picks over the years, maybe you can build something organically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Aaron Holiday, speaking of draft picks, he's played spot minutes occasionally. Then when Victor Oladipo went out, he played significant minutes, played very well. I think that he's going to be one of those guys when you talk about draft picks, because teams like this, yeah, small market teams have to hit it out the park when it comes to the draft. And you just sprinkle in some complimentary players around that and hope that you can do something. I think that's probably more reasonable. Trying to give, you know, think you're going to give a $100 million deal to a free agent. I mean, winning in July isn't really winning. And a lot of teams, unfortunately for them, do that and think, you know, somehow they sign a big-name free agent, gave them a lot of money, it's going to mean something. And I don't see Kevin Pritchard as going to be that type of guy. He's a little bit more common sense about it. But I think it does put them in a better position to be able to make some moves, whatever they may be, next summer. Because they'll be in a position where they could be a playoff team that's advanced, potentially win 50-plus games, and have money in free agency to be able to offer someone something that might be enticing.
Yeah, it's like the Utah Jazz who did the ad, then they lost Gordon Hayward. It's a problem for them. Last question, the trade deadline coming up. It feels like a weird trade deadline to me because there are almost 25 buyers really out there. I mean, 25 teams can legitimately say they are in the mix for a playoff spot. The bottom five teams, you're going to hear more about like the Enes Kanter, Zach Randolph swaps, like inter crappy team swaps that are out there. What's the Pacers' mindset as we go into February?
They have a conservative mindset, I think, when it comes to those sorts of things. Not to have, you know, knee-jerk reactions because you're trying to make a short-term move to compromise yourselves long-term. And that kind of goes to the whole small market thing. I think they're going to be very I think they're going to be cautious.
Is there something they need that would be a difference maker in the playoffs?
I think what they need, they have to figure out is Darren Collison the answer at point guard? Is that going to be the guy that's going to lead you to that point? Because he's had moments where he's been solid player and other times where he's kind of fallen off the map. And can you win, get to that point you want to get with Collison as the guy? I think they believe that they can. And because he's on an expiring deal, they kind of have some latitude where, you know, you could move an expiring deal or you could just ride it out. And, you know, he'll be off your books come this upcoming summer. But you have, like I said, Corey Joseph behind him who plays very well. But Corey Joseph isn't a guy that's going to, you know, get you 25, 30 points in a big game when you really need some buckets. Aaron Holiday is still a rookie. Very unconscious when it comes to shooting. I'm going to tell you what, Aaron Holiday could miss 10 three-pointers in a row and he will go down the court like J.R. Smith. The next one's going in and he's going to launch it, which is can be good.
It feels
and
like
bad.
Marcus Smart a little bit. That's yeah. the irrational confidence yes, that you don't know where it comes from.
It's good because he's a good player and, you know, sometimes it can be bad. And so if Darren Collison doesn't kind of find that level where he can be steady, do you feel by the time we get to the trade deadline you need to do something because you need somebody more consistent at that spot? And to me, that's the biggest question mark with them going forward. At the point guard position is Collison the guy? The other thing is, you know, Thad Young is at the four, fantastic defensive player. He's a guy that shoots inside the arc primarily when he's most effective. They were hoping TJ Leaf could be that spread four that he's not really turned out to be for them. So that's obviously a need for them as well. They play Bogdanovich a lot, by the way, at the four this year. But I don't think another shooter would hurt them at this point. Considering that Tariq Evans is now well under 40% shooting from the field this season. And McDermott's played pretty well in spots, but I still think they can use that one more offensive punch. And, you know, so I would say that I think the point guard's probably the more bigger question mark than anything. But I think deep down they believe regardless they can at least get to the second round with what they've got right now.
Interesting team. And with the way the playoffs shape up, that's going to be a hell of a first round series wherever they land. Yes. Jay, keep up the great work, man. Always appreciate your time.
Likewise, Chris. Appreciate it.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.